Hello and welcome to The Blockchain and Us, where pioneers and thought leaders talk about their journey in blockchain technology, crypto assets, and the token economy. And I'm your host, Manuel Staggers. This episode has support from no official sponsor, but from my very own The Blockchain and Us newsletter. Get an email from me every 2 weeks with a very short summary of new podcast episodes so you can immediately pick those interviews you'd like to listen to. To stay up to date, just visit www.theblockchainandus.com and sign up today. My guest today is Jesse McWaters. Jesse leads the World Economic Forum's exploration of fintech and financial innovation, where he works with financial executives, regulators, and a global network of innovators to analyze the implications of open banking, blockchains, digital identity, and AI on the financial sector and society. Jesse is a frequent speaker and media commentator on CNBC's Closing Bell, in the Financial Times, the Wall Street Journal, Wired, and the New York Times, and he has presented his analyses to financial institutions and global policymakers, such as the Financial Stability Board, the Basel Committee on Banking Supervision, the Federal Reserve Board, the People's Bank of China, the European Parliament, and the FDIC. And now, to the interview. Hi, Jesse, and many thanks for taking time today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Jesse, we made our last interview more than a year ago for the blockchain documentary. And since then, how have you seen the blockchain narrative change?
Well, I think there's been a lot of changes, but probably the largest of them has been the degree to which we've seen blockchain come into the fore as a topic that the public at large is broadly aware of. I mean, I remember I started having conversations about blockchain in early 2014. I was probably aware of it a year or two before that and some of the initial stories that were going around about Bitcoin. But I think it's really been the explosion in the valuation and the diversity of crypto assets that has really made this a popular conversation, not just at financial services conferences, but around the dining room table, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, since then, this topic has really taken off like a rocket, I feel. And, you know, back at the beginning of 2017, many people still weren't aware of the term blockchain. And, you know, you still had to do some explaining there, but I think that's pretty clear today.
I think that's true. I also think that we're starting to see a shift in the blockchain conversation, and one that I think is in a good direction, that we're talking less and less about the how of blockchain, and we're having more difficult, but I think important conversations about the where and the why of blockchain. And so what I mean by that is that a few years ago, really most of the discussions around blockchain were about explaining how it worked, and how it worked generally meant how did the Bitcoin proof of work protocol work. And there was probably too little discussion about when and where it should be used and when and where it made sense, as well as what some of the non-technical challenges around its implementation were. And I think now you're seeing people focus more and more on the question of when is this the right tool to use, and thinking more for any given use case about the capability requirements that they have first, and then about the technology that they want to use. And so you're seeing less and less of this blockchain as a solution looking for a problem, and more as a tool in the toolbox, if you will, to solve those problems.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. At the World Economic Forum, did you also have to change your blockchain narrative?
I think we've had a continuously evolving blockchain narrative. If you look at the one of the first major reports that we published on this topic, The Future of Financial Infrastructure, we present a vision of how various aspects of financial infrastructure, the interbank and interinsurer and interasset manager pipes, if you will, how they could be revolutionized through these types of distributed protocols. And we give some discussion there to the fact that getting stakeholder alignment and the right regulatory and governance protocols in place will be critical hurdles to the actual implementation of these solutions. And I think what we've seen over the last year or two is that more and more discussion is required in those spaces. I mean, obviously, there's some really important work happening in the technical space as well, but the stakeholder alignment is really important. I think one way of thinking about it is that blockchain systems are remarkable ways of keeping a community on the same page, but they don't do anything to get people on the same page in the first place. And so if you want to replace some piece of infrastructure, or if you want to set up a new piece of infrastructure, there's a critical stage of getting stakeholders aligned that needs to happen first.
Mm-hmm. Is this stakeholder alignment, or instead of stakeholders, let's just say, you know, maybe governments, companies, society at large, this alignment of these actors, is this one of the missions of the forum?
Well, the World Economic Forum is a Swiss international organization for public-private collaboration. And so I think absolutely we're looking for opportunities where we can play a role of catalyst in creating new infrastructure. We're also looking at where we can support good governance around the implementation of new and sometimes disruptive technology. And since you and I last talked, we actually have a new center that we've created in San Francisco called our Center for the Fourth Industrial Revolution that's really focused on exactly those questions, understanding how we can shape the transformation of the Fourth Industrial Revolution rather than be shaped by it. And ensure that the implications, both public and private, of using technologies like blockchain are positive.
Mm-hmm. But that goes way beyond blockchain, right?
It does.
What else does it include?
Oh, so we're looking at drones, artificial intelligence, digital trade flows, a whole diverse set of things.
I wanted to ask a little more about what you're specifically doing at the forum. I think you're the project lead of disruptive innovation in financial services, right?
That's right. And so I sit really at the intersection between new technologies and the impact that they're having on the operating models and the competitive dynamics of financial services. And so on blockchain, as with a number of other technologies, we're looking to really think about how it's transforming the structure of financial services.
Mm-hmm. When did you start doing this at the forum?
I started with the forum in November of 2013, and we really kicked off this series of projects looking to understand the role of technology in finance at Davos 2014.
Mm-hmm. But back then, I'm sure blockchain technology was probably not the main focus. So what were the main disruptive technologies back then in financial services?
So I think the key narrative that we looked at when we kicked off this initiative in early 2014 was to understand how new and emerging small companies in this space, which later came to be popularly known as fintech, had the potential to disrupt the business models of financial institutions, legacy financial institutions. And so we had blockchain and Bitcoin specifically on our radar at that time, but we looked at it almost exclusively in our first report as an alternative payment mechanism. And it wasn't really until early 2015 that we had come to see blockchain as a broader, more transformative, potentially general purpose technology. And this narrative of blockchain as an internet of value had really started to take hold with some of our constituents. And that's when we really decided that we were going to dive deeper on understanding this topic. And it's where our first major report, The Future of Financial Infrastructure, came out on this topic.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Just curious, I want to ask something about the fintech space and what you see there. Because I also made an interview series about fintech in Switzerland. And for that, I interviewed lots of people in the fintech space, from banks, but also from startups. And I feel today, when I look at the fintech crowd and maybe the blockchain ecosystem, that they're still quite separate. I mean, what do you observe there?
That's an interesting question. So I guess what I would say is that I think that the road that blockchain innovators are following is to some degree almost definitionally a more difficult path than some of the paths that one can select in the fintech space. And the reason that I would argue that is because I think that at its core, any type of blockchain system is a form of distributed ownership and operation of infrastructure. And that infrastructure is more difficult to build than almost any other type of, than almost any other layer, if you will, in the business stack. And so many fintech players, for example, were looking to find ways of optimizing customer experience or of improving a particular activity along the value chain for investment advisory or the origination of new loans. And so there was a sense in which you could build a better mousetrap and either set about to bring customers to that new piece of technology or to sell it into existing operators in financial services. In almost every case, blockchain innovators are seeking to do something more difficult, that is, establish a new infrastructure. And that's something that you can't really do alone. You need to bring new players to the table, and you need to get a certain critical mass around doing that. And so if that's about a new payment system, it's about driving acceptance of the payment system and interoperability of the infrastructure with other infrastructures. If it's about capital markets, again, it's about how do you get adoption by either existing capital market players, or how do you drive customers to a new platform. So I think that's sort of perhaps part of the difference. I know that when I speak to people in fintech, that they are often very interested in the revolution that they're seeing in blockchain. And many of them are often thinking about how they would integrate their companies into a world in which blockchain was more widely used. But for the vast majority of them, when I have that discussion, they're of the view that the technology is not sufficiently mature enough yet. And so they're looking for increased usage and increased interoperability with the technology.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So it's mainly a technological bottleneck, you think?
Well, I don't know that it is technological. I think it's about maturity vis-a-vis usage. And so in some cases, it may be technological. It may be about scalability, or the latency of existing protocols may not be fit for purpose. But I think more often it's just simply about the fact that most fintechs are operating on, to some degree or another, on legacy infrastructure, right? So they are integrating with existing value transfer mechanisms, existing payment rails. I think in many cases they would be open to using new payment rails or new systems for storage of value, but they aren't necessarily going to be the ones to drive that. They'll build integration with it at such time that those things achieve critical mass.
Well, I think there's also an ideological rift there. I mean, I sometimes feel, you know, because most people I speak with who are very early adopters in the blockchain space, or definitely with cryptocurrencies, have almost this, you know, revolutionary approach to what they're doing, while many people in the fintechs are looking to collaborate, I think, with the incumbents. I mean, it's just an observation that I made.
I think it's certainly true that some folks view disruption of the existing system as a good in and of itself, and others don't. I think that that cuts across both the fintech and the blockchain space, but it's certainly the case that that there are different ideologies present as part of this sort of broader innovation and finance ecosystem.
The last time we spoke, Jesse, in our interview, you said that many people understand the blockchain, but not what it means for their business. So have you seen that change in any way?
Certainly. So I think we've seen a shift in the narrative around blockchain in this space, and I think it's overall healthy. And I'll comment first on what we've seen around the usage of blockchain by existing institutions to replace existing systems. And so I think that a few years ago, you had a lot of people who were looking to educate themselves in the how of how blockchain works. And they were asking themselves a question that ran something along the lines of, how do I use blockchain to do X? And I think that sort of starting with a technical solution in mind approach tended to drive at times towards a bit of what I would call innovation theater, that people wanted to demonstrate that they were aware of blockchain, that they were thinking about its application. And even if a particular application wasn't fit for purpose, they wanted to make sure that they could share with their customers and with their investors that they were experimenting in this space. And I think that even though much of that work may not necessarily have been fit for purpose, it was likely valuable in terms of helping them come to understand where the technology was and wasn't relevant for them, helping them build competence amongst their technology teams. I think that you've increasingly, though, seen a shift to people using blockchain as a license, if you will, to draw a new future for their company on a blank sheet of paper, asking themselves, what are the types of capabilities that we need to have when we replace a given piece of infrastructure? And then to, as they specify that those operational requirements and drive into a set of technical requirements, asking themselves where blockchain technology is and isn't useful in this space. And I think what you're seeing as a result, if you look at initiatives like, for example, the Australian Stock Exchange's deployment of blockchain technology in their new equity settlement system, is that it's less of a binary question. It's less in a question of, will we be a blockchain solution or a not blockchain solution, and more picking and choosing elements of the technology that are fit for purpose at any given time. And I think, obviously, we're also seeing competition wherein some players are choosing to take much less distributed solutions. Others are choosing to take more, and it'll be interesting to see how the competition between those solutions plays out.
I think there's also this dynamic between replacing a whole lot of old infrastructure with blockchain technology or, you know, another, in another sense, distributed ledger technology that may or may not be blockchains, and creating something entirely new, right, in the whole crypto space. Mm-hmm. So how do you see that that dynamic evolve?
So I think that's interesting, because I think that when we were having this dialogue a while ago, there was a real tendency to focus on the narrative of disruption. And I think that one of the things that we've seen is that disrupting existing infrastructure may be, at least in the near term, more difficult than was anticipated. That even if we could deploy a new interbank payment system, for example, that was significantly more efficient than the SWIFT system, that one would face a challenge in terms of getting a sufficient number of global financial institutions to switch systems. I think that any sort of switch in this space was always going to require a short-term increase in cost in some sense, because you were likely going to have to run both the old system and the new disruptive system in parallel.
Right.
And so I think that has created something of a barrier to switching. And we've seen a shift, if you will, to more focus on this movement of tokenization. That is a focus on finding assets or bundles of rights or digital pieces of media where previously price discovery was difficult, liquidity was low, and where people are experimenting to see whether or not the deployment of distributed systems around those assets or those sets of rights can help to generate improved liquidity and to build new markets. And I think that's a really interesting set of effort and one that I'm watching quite closely.
Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, when I quoted what you said in our last interview there before, people understand what the blockchain, but not what it means for their business. I mean, sometimes I feel it's almost the other way around. I mean, people have a business angle or a goal they want to achieve with, you know, what blockchain technology may promise, but it's still very hard to actually understand what the technology can do.
I think that's quite true, and I think that's in part because it's evolving, and I think it's in part because there's a tendency for non-technical people to dive into the technical aspects of blockchain, which is, I think, in a sense, a bit of an interesting aberration of blockchain as a technology.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I feel exactly what you're saying, and it's what I know from my own experience, but also from lots of people I observe, who once they get in touch with this technology and spent, you know, a few months reading, they kind of almost, you know, disappear in this vortex. And then, you know, I have all these kind of expectations as well on, you know, how the future may be and how they can play a role in the future. So I think, you know, there's really a big draw in this technology that previously just didn't exist.
I think one of the most exciting things about blockchain, one of the things that's been really exciting within organizations, is that it gives people a license to imagine a future almost without constraint. I think there's a tendency sometimes amongst non-technical people to think of blockchain in the early stages as magic. And I think that there's actually a value to the freedom that gives individuals to re-examine their business and their relationship with their customers and their suppliers and others. Now, as you actually go into the process of implementation, I think that you need to, you know, take that vision and think about how you operationalize it and what the best technology is to operationalize any given piece of that vision. But I think that blockchain as magic piece can actually be valuable in the early stages of re-envisioning one's company.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's one interviewee said something very nice. He said, "Blockchain is not magic, but it's magical." It's always important, even as a non-technical person, to come up with a call to action, what it actually means. And about that, also in our last interview, you said, as a society, we should shape the development of the blockchain. So I'm wondering, how can people do that?
Let's take a quick break for a message from our sponsors. This episode has support from no official sponsor, but from my very own The Blockchain and Us newsletter. Get an email from me every 2 weeks with a very short summary of new podcast episodes so you can immediately pick those interviews you'd like to listen to. To stay up to date, just visit www.theblockchainandus.com and sign up today.
As a society, we should shape the development of the blockchain. So I'm wondering, how can people do that?
Well, I think that one of the things that we're seeing a lot of discussion about right now is appropriate regulation of the new assets that are emerging through the deployment of ICOs and other forms of monetizing tokens. And I think that there's a growing recognition amongst many in the crypto space, as well as amongst regulators and incumbent financial institutions, that regulation has played a valuable role in the emergence and management of the centralized financial system, and that many of those principles should carry over to this new crypto system. And so a lot of the discussions that I'm having, for example, center around consumer protection. And so I think that we're seeing obviously a lot of interesting opportunities to make speculative investments in the token space. But I think we know that those investments are often high risk in nature. We know that sometimes there are scams, and that in a larger number of times, there may be very well-intentioned people who are deploying systems that may not be yet ready to really receive the size of capital infusion that they receive. And that puts a strain in many ways on the fairly nascent governance structures that they have in place. And so I think that the principle of what's called in securities law, for example, suitability, is really important here.
Can you explain briefly what that means, suitability?
Well, are we sure that the right checks and balances are in place to ensure that people are aware of the risks around the assets that they're building? And so, a classic example of this that's used sometimes when people explain this principle is that one ought not sell to an 85-year-old widow who's reliant on a continuous stream of income a bunch of exploratory oil and gas mining stocks. I think that's a hyperbolic example, but we obviously have a notion that there are particular types of investments that are suitable for particular types of investors. And so I think if you look at a lot of securities commissions around the world today, they can be concerned about whether or not the retail money that's being invested in this space is properly informed around the risks. And if you think about the way in which securities law exists around having requirements for equities filings, those requirements are largely built around the idea that people should have some degree of transparency into the investment that they're making. And new investment prospectuses, for example, are really held to a fairly high standard in terms of explaining the risks and opportunities around a particular investment opportunity. And so you're seeing, for example, new groups forming that are looking to create voluntary codes of conduct around appropriate governance of these new crypto assets. And so I work, for example, with the Global Digital Finance Organization, who are right now in the process of working with lawyers, regulators, incumbent institutions, as well as many leading voices in the blockchain development space, to think about how tokens with different purposes should be regulated differently, and how those regulations can be brought into some degree of alignment with existing regulations, particularly where they're designed to protect the rights of consumers or to help foster financial systemic stability.
I'm actually very interested in this code of conduct. The CFA has quite a strict code of conduct for asset managers. And so I've been wondering for the longest time why some of these funds or ICOs haven't just simply adopted, that very rigorous standard.
I think that there is there are certainly opportunities to take some existing regulations and code of conduct and to port them into the crypto space. I think just like one shouldn't sell an exploratory oil and gas stock to an 85-year-old widow, she probably shouldn't be buying or being sold the newest token issuance either. Those are both sort of high-risk assets with long-time horizons to the realization of their value that probably aren't suited to her investment needs. Mm-hmm. At the same time, there are some ways in which crypto assets are, it would seem, quite different from existing assets. And so there's a lot of discussion right now being given to the notion that over time, a token might move from one category to another. There's a lot of work being done right now around so-called consumer or utility tokens. But they're interesting because in the short term, they look a lot like equity investments poised for growth. in the long term, they may evolve into something like airtime minutes, for example, more a digital asset that is redeemable for a particular type of service. Those two assets require somewhat different forms of regulation. And so if assets are going to, or tokens are going to transition from one type of asset to another, we'll need to think about how to measure that and how to make sure that the codes of conduct or the regulations of the assets are suitable as they make those shifts.
Jesse, do you also often work with banks?
Yes, I speak with banks all of the time. And I think that one of the really interesting things that we're seeing in this space is what I think for many might be a somewhat unexpected evolution, wherein banks and asset managers and market utilities are starting to think about the role that they could play with crypto assets as yet another asset in the sort of, you know, broad slate of assets that they do work with. And I call this in a sense that we've had this shift, if you will, from blockchain, not Bitcoin, which was something that was frequently getting said 2 or 3 years ago, which was another way of saying people were interested in the idea of blockchain as an infrastructure building block, and they weren't interested in the assets. Today, I think we have a lot of people who are interested in Bitcoin, but not blockchain. And what I mean by that...
At banks, you mean?
Well, I think as end consumers in some sense, because I think the significant increase that we've seen in public awareness of these assets is driving individuals to be interested in taking some portion of their portfolio and making investments in the space. But one cannot simply call one's broker and ask them to, take a $5,000 position in Bitcoin for you. It's the crypto asset system and the traditional financial system are somewhat operating in separate and parallel worlds. And in order to go and acquire a piece of, say, a new token issuance, you need to go to a new financial institution. Maybe shouldn't be called a financial institution, but certainly to an exchange venue in the crypto space, and take fiat and convert it into Bitcoin or Ether, typically, and then often take that to a second exchange in order to purchase the token, and then to go through the complex work of either figuring out a reliable hot wallet provider or to move that to sort of self-custodianship in a cold wallet. That's a rather complicated stream, and it's one where people are subject to a lot of operational risk that they may not necessarily be used to in their interactions with the traditional financial system. And so you've seen an increasing interest on the part of various traditional institutions in providing exposure to these assets without the complexity of directly interacting with their blockchain underpinnings, if you will. And so I think it's interesting that we see traditional financial institutions increasingly possibly playing a role as bridge between these emerging market venues and the existing financial system.
One of the roles of the banks could be this bridge. And I was just about to ask you where the banks themselves see their role in this new crypto asset space in the future. Where else beyond or besides that bridge function, do you see them play a role?
I think that remains to be seen. I think that we've seen the greatest interest over the medium term in capital markets players. So it's been investment managers, custodians, exchanges have been looking at this closely, because there's a clear need for those types of services in the space. We've seen exchanges like Coinbase are highly profitable enterprises at the moment. We've seen challenges around custodianship with the large number of hacks that have happened with the loss of assets as a result. And there's clearly a growing market for analysts and investment advisors around these various crypto assets. I think we're seeing banks from the sort of traditional notion of banks as a provider of credit and as a deposit account holder watching these this evolution closely. But at the moment, I don't think it's quite clear the role that those more traditional banking operations would have in integrating with the blockchain space.
When we spoke, you know, last in our interview, you said that first when you heard about Bitcoin, you dismissed it, but then slowly warmed to it. Was there a specific realization that convinced you back then?
That's a good question. I think that initially when I first learned about Bitcoin, the thing that that struck me as odd was the deflationary money supply. And I think my traditional economics education suggested that a deflationary money supply was not really a sensible way of setting up a currency. Now, there are many people who have smart arguments on both sides of that set of views, and I've had lots of discussions about it over the years. But I think that for me, what was really interesting was the idea that blockchain was an innovation in record keeping around transfer of value. It was a rather elegant solution to the double spend problem. And it really seemed evident that there were an enormous number of areas in which that could potentially be useful, and that it would be a fascinating thing to try and think about which areas it would be most valuable to. I think I may have initially thought that that question, the answer to that question, would be easier to discover than it has. I'm not sure that I'm certain today on any particular application as being optimal for blockchain or specifically for proof of work implementation like Bitcoin. But I think it's going to be really interesting to watch over the next 3 to 5 years as various implementations compete to try and build scale in this space.
I mean, the whole narrative for Bitcoin, decentralization, you know, disruption of the existing financial system, is that something that's attractive to you, or do you think it's maybe, you know, not going to pan out how many people think?
I'm personally not interested in disruption for disruption's sake. And I think that sometimes systems can be made better through disruption and other times through constructive addition and renovation, if you will. And so I don't have a particular view that disruption is the only way of transforming the financial system. I'm excited by the potential for a financial system that is more inclusive. I'm particularly excited by one that gives individuals greater control over their data and provides them with better services around their assets and investments. And if that comes through disruption, that's good. If that comes through other paths that are less disruptive, then I think that's good as well.
Mm-hmm. How instrumental do you think blockchain technology will be in that kind of future that you just described?
I think it absolutely remains to be seen. One thing that I think could be interesting is that we could see blockchain become less of a binary idea than it is today. It really remains to be seen the impact that that blockchain will have. It may indeed prove to be instrumental, and I think the next few years will prove extremely valuable in providing us with the evidence that we need to understand the future of the financial ecosystem.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Jesse, if you look at some of the newer developments in the whole blockchain ecosystem, maybe, you know, that took place over the last year or months, what has been a surprise for you recently?
I think I've been surprised at the speed with which ICOs have grown and have continued to grow. And it shows that there's clearly an enormous amount of interest in the ability for blockchain technology to be used in setting up new infrastructure that's built on this distributed foundation. At the same time, I've watched with interest that there's a growing number of those projects that have been abandoned. And I think it's going to be really interesting to see a few years from now which of these have been successful and have really managed to drive growth and adoption, and which ones will be less successful. And I actually think that as a community, it's really important that we keep good records around that, that we track closely the types of problems that prove insurmountable for these new endeavors, and those where they grow most rapidly. And that'll really help us to understand where capital can best be deployed around distributed systems. And we can hopefully start to get to a point of greater clarity about the type of path that we'll see blockchain take over the next 5 to 10 years.
How do you keep yourself informed about, you know, what happens in the ecosystem and in the whole blockchain and crypto space?
Well, there's obviously a lot of news sources that have emerged over the last few years on this, and a few newsletters that I try and keep myself up to date on. But I think that I've been lucky enough to form a lot of very friendly relationships with people from all different subsectors of the crypto space, people within a number of different communities. And I find that the most effective way is sort of talking with them about the projects that they're working on and about their general outlook for the evaluation of the space. Their views are often wildly divergent from one another. And I think that by bringing them all together, it can be a really valuable way of sort of thinking about some of the scenarios and narratives for the ecosystem as it continues to evolve.
That was really interesting, Jesse. Thanks a lot for your views on the space and your outlooks. And I really appreciate your taking time today.
Thanks so much, Manuel. It's been a great discussion. And I think it's a really exciting space for us to continue to track and think about.
Thanks so much for joining us today. More info on our guests and our sponsors is in the show notes of this episode and on the podcast website, theblockchainandus.com. To help people find this podcast, it's important that you download, subscribe, and give it a top rating and review on iTunes or on the podcast platform of your choice. I'm Manuel Staggers, and I thank you very much for listening.